The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So, the last few times I've been here, I've been talking about exploring the sense of self and identification and identity, and last time we had a question and answer session that was largely around that. And I've also said a number of times over the last few weeks that, sometimes we can maybe very clearly recognize a sense of identity or identification. Sometimes it's in our face. It's like, I want, I need, the sense of self-righteousness or some sense of strong identification. Sometimes it's obvious, and sometimes it's not so obvious. And one of the things the Buddha explored, one of the teachings of the Buddha, I think I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, there's a teaching called the Teaching of Dependent Origination. And it basically explores how suffering comes to be. It explores the conditions that come into play together to create suffering arising in our experience. And that description of suffering, of how suffering comes to be, is the same description that's used to describe how a sense of self comes to be. And so we can explore our experience through either the experience of suffering of what the in the Pali, dukkha, or through this sense of self. And sometimes the sense of dukkha or suffering, dissatisfaction, stress, is what's more obvious to us. And so this exploration or pointing, actually, this pointing that the sense of selfing, the sense of self arising and the identification process and the process of the creation of dukkha in our minds being the same process gives us different pointers into the experience. And so when suffering is obvious, when stress or dissatisfaction is what's obvious, sometimes it's not so helpful to try to say, well, what's the sense of self in here? You can go right for just exploring, what's this suffering? What's this experience of suffering? And so that's the avenue I'd like to explore today, to explore what is this teaching around dukkha, the Pali term dukkha. And this is not a small thing, actually, in the Buddhist teaching. And one time he said, what I teach is suffering and its end. This whole teaching was kind of oriented around this question of suffering, of dukkha. And it was a different perspective than was being offered for spiritual paths in the time that he was in the time in India when he was around. Often the orientation was around the creation or cultivation of deep states of concentration, of mystical states, of union, of oneness, things like that. And wanderer, a person from another sect, came and was having a conversation with the Buddha and said, the recluse Gautama does not have any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. The recluse Gautama teaches a Dhamma hammered out by reasoning, following his own line of inquiry as it occurs to him. And when he teaches the Dhamma to anyone, it leads him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering. And the Buddha's response to this is, Sanakata, who is the person who made this comment, Sanakata is angry and his words are spoken out of anger. Thinking to discredit the Tathagata, which is how that's a term he used to describe himself, thinking to discredit the Tathagata, he actually praises him. For it is praise to say, when he teaches the Dhamma to anyone, it leads him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering. That this the complete destruction of suffering is the aim and the direction of this practice that the Buddha taught, not the creation of any special states of being. So this term, dukkha, I'm going to explore that a little bit, because we usually use the word suffering to translate that term. But in our English language, suffering is a pretty strong word. And one teacher, actually, Steve Armstrong, talks about one of his first retreats. And he went to this retreat, and he actually apparently thought he was going to a spa or something. And he ended up in the back of the room, and he stayed. He hung out, and he's kind of listening to these talks, and it's like, huh, this is kind of interesting. And he heard them talk a lot about dukkha, and he's going, dukkha, I don't have any of that. Or suffering, I don't have any of that. Here he was with his body in pain and, kind of judging and angry about, what people were talking. It's like, suffering? I don't have any of that. And so clearly he wasn't seeing in that experience, the kind of depth and subtlety that the word dukkha conveys. So I'm going to give you some alternative words. Some other ways that it's translated in particular are distress or stress or dissatisfaction, something like that. So that conveys a little bit more of the breadth of what this word actually means. And then there's a whole bunch of words that are in the terrain that one Buddhist scholar suggests. See if you're familiar with any of these. Disturbance, irritation, dejection, worry, despair, fear, dread, anguish, anxiety, inferiority, boredom, pain, frustration, longing, aimlessness, hopelessness, striving, repression, loss, want, insufficiency, lovelessness, dislike, aversion, submission, rebellion, vacillation, uncertainty. All of those states contain this quality of being basically dissatisfied with what's happening here and now. And that level of dissatisfaction of something happening here and now is in this terrain of dukkha. So they're different. The Buddha talked about different ways we experience dukkha, different forms of dukkha. But it's all related to, essentially, not the experience itself, So, for example, if something is unpleasant, and this relates to the first kind of dukkha that the Buddha talked about, the dukkha due to pain or unpleasant experience. The term he used for this was dukkha-dukkha. The dukkha due to pain or unpleasantness. It's not the pain or the unpleasantness itself that is what the Buddha called dukkha. Or in terms of the exploration of what can be released. What the complete destruction of dukkha is, he says, is what he taught. The complete destruction of dukkha. And yet the unpleasantness, particularly unpleasantness in the body, just comes with being a human being. That is not going to end, ever. Well, until we die. But then there's whatever happens next. So, the dukkha that the Buddha is talking about that can come to an end is related to how we relate to our experience. So around unpleasant experience, we typically don't like it. We want to push it away. We want to get rid of it. And around unpleasant experience in particular, the Buddha offered a teaching where he said, when an ordinary person, a person who has not understood suffering, understood this wanting things to be other than they are, basically. Basically we have something unpleasant happening, we want it to be other than it is, and so there's an agitation, a disturbance in the mind about that, leading to trying to want us to fix or change or get rid of something along those lines. And so that disturbance in the mind, that agitation in the mind, that aversion, that irritation, that some of these words I talked about, anguish, dread, fear, dislike, submission or rebellion, vacillation, those states of mind lead us to not being at ease with what's happening in the present moment. And that is what he called dukkha. That is what he says can come to an end. He said it is possible to be in the moment with unpleasant experience and be at peace and be at ease. And this doesn't necessarily mean that peacefulness doesn't necessarily mean that we don't take action in the next moment to change something. But it does mean we are not acting out of reactivity, but rather from wisdom, from a heart that's not contracted, but from a heart that is open and responsive to the situation, that understands with wisdom what is the way forward to potentially even alleviate suffering. The heart of compassion has that wish to alleviate suffering. The heart of compassion is not a contracted, aversive state, but rather an open, receptive, responsive state. So the dukkha that the Buddha described and talked about is a mental quality. It's that, you know, agitation around things as they are, an inability to be okay with things as they are in this moment, an inability to be at ease or at peace with things as they are in this moment. It's like what is happening now, what's happening right now, is already happening. Sometimes, you know, it's like resistance is futile, actually. It's here. It's already here. And the what we typically do in this very moment is clamp down or resist or push or want to hold on to or fix or change. And the Buddha, the paradox, it's a kind of paradoxical where the Buddha suggests if you can actually open to this moment, if you can actually open to this experience, what's already here without resistance, then wisdom helps us to determine what the best thing to do in the next moment may be. And that may be some kind of action. You know, if you're sitting, you know, if you're sitting in a building and a fire alarm goes off, you know, to just sit there and listen to the noise is not, you know, necessarily, it's not the skillful action. So, you know, understanding the conditions and circumstances of what's happening. So there is the sound, often fire alarms, we have them happening at IRC on occasion. The system has some false alarms at times, and it's a painful experience. It's loud enough and harsh enough to make you want to get out of the building. So it's got an unpleasant quality to it. And yet it doesn't have to be from reactivity that we act to move and to leave the building. It can be from the understanding of wisdom. If I don't leave the building, there may be problems. So that the understanding of being at ease with things as they are in this moment doesn't mean non-action. Sometimes it does. I mean, there's a remarkable amount of the time that we are reactive to something. Like, for instance, you know, the sound of a leaf blower, which we have here at times. You know, that's a sound, and you know, you might think that a skillful response. You know, it might occur to you, and it's certainly, you know, used to be an approach that my mind would take. It's like, gosh, doesn't that person know we're meditating? You know, maybe I should go tell them that we're meditating so that he can do this later. I mean, you know, really, this is a meditation center. He shouldn't be doing that right now. So, you know, the mind might do that and think that that action was necessary. And yet very often And this is a place for us to explore. When we are reactive to something that is what we think of as unpleasant, sometimes it is an idea in the mind that's unpleasant, rather than the actual experience. The sound of a leaf blower, you know, this is kind of a buzzing sound. It's actually usually not painful. It is, you know, it's, if you're not reactive to it, and this I've noticed actually, if you're not reactive to the sound of a leaf blower, it's a pretty neutral sound. It's just a kind of buzzing sound. And so, you know, very often we discover with unpleasant experience that reactivity is optional, that it's a habit of some sort, in fact, you know, that we have ideas about how things should be, or, and this is where the sense of self comes in, right? This is, we have ideas, it should be like this, we've been, you know, we've had our upbringing, our conditioning has led us to believe that this is how things should be, and we carry those ideas and opinions around with us, and that influences how we relate to experience. So the Buddha talked about this dukkha as being a mental construct, a mental experience, how we relate to experience. And he pointed to three different ways that we relate to experience. One is around unpleasant experience, that dukkha can be created around unpleasant experiences. This is the dukkha I talked about. I'll go into it a little bit more in just a moment. And then he talked about there actually being dukkha around pleasant experience. This is what's sometimes called the dukkha due to change. That because experience is pleasant, I mean, because experience is impermanent, pleasant experience inherently is not a reliable place for happiness. That pleasant experience will change, and if we kind of land on a pleasant experience and hold on to it and think this is the way it's supposed to be, we will suffer when it changes and goes away. So this is the dukkha due to change. And then the third kind of dukkha is the dukkha due to sometimes it's called dukkha due to existence. That's kind of the most subtle form of dukkha. So I'll see if I can talk a little bit about each of these and then hopefully save a little time for some questions and comments. So the first kind, dukkha, this dukkha due to pain. This is the kind of dukkha we usually don't miss. I mean, it is obvious. Something unpleasant is happening in our experience and we are reactive to it. So the Buddha talked about this unpleasant mental reactivity to unpleasant physical experience. I mean, this dukkha is related either to unpleasant physical or mental experience, but it's easiest to kind of check into and see around unpleasant physical experience. So let's start the exploration there. And the Buddha started the exploration there too. He said, you know, that an ordinary person, when they experience unpleasant physical sensation, they have the unpleasant physical sensation, and then they add to that mental reactivity. Woe is me. Why is this happening to me? Can't I get rid of this? Can't I fix this? Why can't I change this? This is a problem. So to the unpleasant physical experience, we add an unpleasant mental experience of aversion or a feeling of failure or distress somehow. And so that, what he says is, it's if somebody who's been hit by a dart or an arrow basically picks up another arrow and stabs himself in the same place. So that to the unpleasant physical experience is added another unpleasant experience, the second one being mental. And he goes on to say, and somebody who has been trained, who understands their mind, who understands suffering, has that unpleasant experience, that unpleasant physical experience, and what they experience is an unpleasant physical experience. Full stop. they don't react to that unpleasant. It's simply, oh, that's an unpleasant experience. The mind is not reactive to it, not pulled out of balance, pulled out of gotta fix, gotta change, gotta do, gotta get rid of, gotta. So it's not got that mental agitation around it. There's a peacefulness in the mind around what is happening. So the that addition of that second arrow, if you start to look at this in your own experience, and as I was suggesting in the guided meditation, you know, there's the experience, you know, in the guided meditation I was suggesting, you know, just opening to the flow of what's happening, you might notice sounds, and then noticing the difference between the sound and the reaction or relationship to the sound. If you start to explore this in your experience, it becomes really, really clear that most of what we call pain, what most of what we experience as the difficulty of something being unpleasant has to do with our reaction to it. It's more than just an additive impact of adding an unpleasant mental experience to an unpleasant physical experience. It's more like it multiplies it. So the unpleasant physical experience multiplied by the unpleasant mental experience creates a state of quite a bit of distress. And that is the dukkha, that distress. So that distress then kind of can create a positive feedback loop, a positive feedback loop. It's interesting, it's a funny word. You know, we think of, you know, positive feedback loop is a loop that builds on itself. It strengthens itself naturally. And so we have an unpleasant mental experience, which creates an even more unpleasant physical experience, which then creates an even worse unpleasant mental experience, which makes the whole experience even more painful, which then we react to even more, just building on itself. And so it just multiplies and multiplies and multiplies. We add the second, the third, the eighth, the 27th arrow, the 16th arrow, the 128th arrow. We keep adding arrows, reacting to our reactions. We react both to physical experience and to mental experience. So this kind of dukkha, what the Buddha asks us actually for all forms of dukkha is to understand it, to get to know this process, to observe in our experience, and see if we can, at any point we notice dukkha, at any point we notice, whether it's at the first arrow or the 28th arrow, wherever we are in that process, this is dukkha. This is dukkha. This shift, actually, the first noble truth, the Buddha talks about this noble truth of there is suffering. And in that discourse, when he talked about the first noble truth, he said, there's three insights to be had around suffering. The first one is, this is suffering. Or there is suffering. This is suffering. What is happening? This is suffering. Or the recognition that this whole out of control process is dukkha is actually an insight. I think that's important to recognize, because when we're caught in that cycle, we are believing that there's something that we can't, that we need to do to fix, to change in that out-of-control reactive cycle. We are not cognizant that this is a process happening in the mind and that there is a possibility to be aware of it. And so that shift, that's my understanding of what that first understanding or first insight around dukkha represents. It represents a shift from being caught in the reactivity, that cycle of reactivity, to recognizing, oh, this is a process that's happening in the mind. And it also represents a kind of a turning from the belief that there's something out there that I need to fix or change or control, and to turn towards the reactive process in the mind. That's what that first insight represents, is to make that shift, to see what can be learned, what can be understood. And that's the second insight, actually, the Buddha said about suffering, that it should be understood. that first to recognize this is a process, a mental process of stress, dissatisfaction, unease, suffering, the word that most resonates for you, and be helpful to recognize that. And then this should be understood. And by understanding, he doesn't mean thinking about it. He doesn't mean reflecting on it and thinking about why it's happening, but rather what is the experience in the moment of this stress, dissatisfaction, suffering. The Buddha's understanding, when he talks about understanding, it's not an intellectual one. It's a direct experiential recognition of what's happening in the moment. And that turning towards that direct experiential understanding of what's happening in the moment begins to help us see all of these pieces of, okay, there's, for example, let's go back to the sound of the leaf blower. Okay, there's the sound happening, and then there's all these ideas and thoughts that are happening. I mean, I had this very clearly showed to me on one evening when I was meditating late at night. I had woken up and I was having trouble sleeping, so I got up to meditate. And while I was meditating, I was hearing this very quiet sound, a tapping sound. And I experienced that as unpleasant. And so there was a kind of contraction around it, and it's like I was trying to ignore it, and I just going back, the tapping was happening, and there was this contraction. And I began to recognize, the first thought in my mind was that tapping is unpleasant, you know. That's where the unpleasantness is in the tapping itself, in the sound itself. And as I began to explore, I saw that there was that contraction in the body whenever the sound happened. That was unpleasant. That was really clearly unpleasant, the grabbing in the body, the way the body tightened and contracted. So I noticed that was unpleasant. So there was the sound that was unpleasant, and there was this contracting that was unpleasant. And then I recognized that as the sound happened, because it would start and stop, as the sound happened, there was a little bit of fear that came up. So this is the exploration, right? This is not thinking about. This is exploring in the moment. Exploring, okay, there's the sound. Oh, there's contraction happening in the body with that sound and being aware of that. And as I was aware in the present moment of that contracting in the body, I noticed fear. This took a while for me to recognize there was fear associated with this sound. It was a subtle fear. It wasn't like a really big fear, but it was a subtle fear. And the fear was unpleasant. So I had the sound, which I thought was unpleasant. I had the contraction in the body that was unpleasant, and the fear, which was unpleasant, all kind of working together to create this unpleasant experience. And as the mind recognized the unpleasant mental experience, the fear, the next time I heard the sound, the fear was very clear. And it was clear to me in that moment that the sound itself was not unpleasant. It was just this. It was a very quiet little tapping sound. The sound itself was pretty neutral. What was unpleasant was my idea that there was something maybe in my wall, a rat perhaps. You know, that was unpleasant idea. You know, so that was a very clear demonstration to me of how this process works in the mind. Demonstrated not by thinking about it, but by meeting in the moment what's happening now. What am I noticing now? So that understanding of how something, a very neutral sound, can be turned into an experience of an unpleasant sound and reacted to was very clear in my, just by watching what was happening. This is the instruction of the Buddha around suffering should be understood, to understand how it's created, what happens in the mind. So let's see if there's more to say here. I think I'll move on to the second kind, because there's always more to say. The second kind of dukkha is a little bit less obvious than the first kind being that dukkha due to unpleasant experience. You know, it's really clear when something's unpleasant and we're reacting to it that it's unpleasant. You know, it's pretty clear that we're suffering. That can be one of the easier ways to turn towards and begin to, okay, this is suffering. The second kind, the suffering due to change, can sometimes be a little less obvious. So this can be the suffering that is like hidden within pleasant experience. It comes about because we are trying to hold to pleasant experience, to keep it, because we somewhere inside of us, we know that that pleasant experience will change. And we are trying to go against the tide of that change and hold on to it for as long as we possibly can. So we have this tension in the mind around pleasant experience, which often is not actually recognized. It's not usually recognized that we've been holding on to pleasant experience until the pleasant experience goes away. And then we feel like it's a problem. You know, it's like we miss the thing because it's gone. We may feel like we've done something wrong, or we're a failure somehow for not being able to hold on to that thing. This actually happens a lot. You know, there's a very, I think, deeply ingrained belief in us that we should be able to live a life where everything is pleasant, or everything is at least the way we'd like it to be. That's kind of almost our definition of what it means to be in control, or, you know, to have charge, to be in charge, is that we can control the environment so that we have experiences we want and don't have experiences that we don't want. And so when it's proven to us, actually, that we aren't in control, this is distressing to us. And because it's such a deeply ingrained belief, we often feel like, what did I do wrong? You know, why is this happening to me? You know, I'm a good person, or maybe this proves I'm not a good person. You know, it's quite deep in us, this belief that we should be able to control our experience, to control the world. So this kind of clinging and beliefs are pointed out to us when the pleasant ends and we experience the pain of loss, of separation, of grief. So there is a kind of again, it's kind of an agitation or a wobbling or a wavering in our minds when something pleasant ends, a feeling of dissatisfaction. So that we could say in a way that the suffering of that, the suffering of the due to change, the suffering that's due to holding to pleasant experience, is kind of hidden in the pleasant experience. Because very often the pleasure that we're getting from having the thing is masking the very subtle, it's a subtler kind of agitation that at some level knows this thing is going to go away, or that I need to kind of endlessly do things to kind of keep up with this flow of change in order to keep myself in a situation where I feel okay. I have to kind of endlessly do things. So the that subtlety of endlessly doing is masked often by the pleasure that we get from having something. So it's kind of masked there. There's something more I wanted to say about that. It's gone. So the process that happens, and again, how it's kind of masked, how this suffering of getting what we want is kind of masked, of suffering of having is masked, is because we are so focused on the having. We're so focused on that. And we also have a little bit of relief that comes from, let me just describe the process of how this works. So if we want something, we want to have something. There's the mind projecting forward to how it's going to be when I get that thing. So we are kind of, we have a pleasant idea in our mind about how happy I'm going to be when I get that thing. So in the future, in the next, even if it's like 2 seconds from now, it might be 2 seconds from now, it might be a month or a year from now, you know, planning, you know, we live our lives this way, planning and orienting towards the future. And we often live in the idea of how it's going to be rather than in the experience of what's actually happening now. And in that, almost living in the idea of how it's going to be, there's some sense of pleasantness, both of the pleasantness of the idea of the having and the pleasantness of the idea or the sense of I'm in control of my life. The feeling of being in control is one of the most pleasant experiences to an ordinary person, I think. You know, it's like there's a really good feeling when, yeah, I figured that out. I can do this. I can change things. I can affect these things. It feels pretty good. And so those experiences of pleasantness mask the kind of the agitation around the wanting to have something. But if we start to look in the moment, we start to look in the moment of what's going on when we're heading towards the future, fantasizing about what we're going to have, we see that largely the pleasantness that we're having in that moment is around this idea of control and around the idea of how it's going to be sometime in the future. It's not actually about how we are right now. And when we look at how we are right now, we see this kind of out of balance movement of wanting something. The moment we want something, there's already a feeling of lack. There's already a feeling that something's off or something's wrong. And so that very experience of lack is masked by the fact that we're usually in our fantasy of how it's going to be. And so this exploration of how is it now, this is a kind of an instruction around this is, you know, turn from the thing that you think you want towards the experience here and now, and you will begin to discover the underlying kind of off-kilterness of that wish. And it's not, again, it's not the wish, it's not the doing itself that's a problem. Because we are going to do. we are going to act. We are acting beings. What's the issue here is this mind that is projecting, first of all, the mind that is moving into the future and thinking this is how it's going to be, and essentially depending and relying on that future. And when that future may not come to be, boy, do we suffer. So the exploration might be to recognize the wanting. Can we recognize the wanting and act in the acting? Well, we're going to have mixed motivations. We are probably going to have wanting, but there is probably also in many of our actions a wholesome motivation too. And so can we connect more to that wholesome wish of, yes, I need to, you know, so I want to find it, I want to get a job, for instance. So yes, that there can be a wanting there. And the wanting may be around envisioning, you know, like, you know, this job is going to be the perfect job, and when I get there, I'm going to be really good at what I do, and people are going to praise me, and they're going to, and boy, you know, we start feeling better and better with that fantasy. And you know, suppose that particular job, somebody else gets that job. Whew, that whole fantasy collapses and we suffer because we have been identifying with that particular outcome, the need for that particular outcome. Now, the need to have a job, the desire to have a job, to take care of yourself, to take care of your family, to put food on the table, to, you know, that's wholesome. That's not an issue. The place to look is when we're leaning. Am I back? Okay. So where it is a problem is that leaning in, that sense of it's got to be this way. That's that clinging. That's that craving. So the dukkha of change is inherent in the clinging around the pleasant. It's inherent in the clinging. It's not inherent in the change itself. And this is a really important thing to recognize, that we can be at ease with change. This is what one of the things the Buddha pointed to, that we can be at ease with change. And so now I'll talk about the last one again. Wow, I have so much more to say about each of these. The third kind is called the dukkha of existence. It's like got some of the subtlest kinds of dukkha in it. And, you know, it's sometimes also called the suffering of formation, of just the coming into being of experience. This kind of suffering is a very, very subtle. It contains the subtlest kinds of unease. I sometimes think of this as the Buddhist version of existential anxiety. You know, just the subtlest sense of, you know, I walk through the world and there's seeing and there's smelling and there's hearing, there's tasting and there's touching and there's thoughts and ideas and, you know, and at a more gross level, it's like, yeah, I get up in the morning and I make my breakfast and I go to work and then I, you know, have my lunch and then I work some more and then I come home and then I go to, you know, make dinner and then I go to bed and then I go to sleep and then I wake up and I go to work and then I go to lunch and it's just endless living of life. And we have a relationship to that sometimes. Is this all there is? Is this all there is? And in the understanding of what's happening, you know, at a grosser level, we can see that kind of sense of, is this all there is? And in the teachings of the Buddha, he pointed to, well, really all there is six things happening. Ever, all there are six things happening: sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch, and things going on in the mind. That's all that ever happens. That's it. And the rest of it is ideas and opinions about what configurations of those six things we should be having. So the relationship that we have to just this kind of very basic level of existence, and is this all there is? Paradoxically, coming into alignment with this is all there is brings a deep happiness and sense of interesting form of purpose, in effect, because in coming into alignment with that truth, we see just how much we have been suffering from not being in alignment with that very simplicity of this is all there is. Not being in alignment with that simplicity, we suffer. And we see, we understand, it, as we, even for just a few moments, come into alignment with that truth, this is what there is. Sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, thoughts, emotions, mood, just tumbling forward forever. And, you know, just tumbling forward. as we come into alignment with that and we see that the suffering in our own minds was a relationship to wanting things to be a certain way and wanting things not to be a certain way, we understand how dukkha works. And boy, our heart opens with compassion for the world, for seeing just how much suffering is happening because people are not in alignment with this truth. And that compassion can lead us to action, because compassion has that movement to action, the compassion to help to alleviate the suffering of the world. It brings a very interesting, heart-opening kind of meaning to come into alignment with this truth. It seems so paradoxical. So I mentioned the first two insights around dukkha that the Buddha talked about in the First Noble Truth. There is dukkha. And that is really just the acknowledgement or recognition of when we are experiencing dukkha, that's what's happening. You know, to turn towards it rather than to believe we've done something wrong or believe we have to fix it or change it. So to turn towards it in the way that I described around that tapping noise, really that should be understood. So that understanding coming through meeting with direct experience. Whatever experience we're having, can be understood in this very direct way, and it will begin to reveal some very subtle ways that we hold and cling. It will reveal the subtle forms of suffering. So, dukkha should be known. That shift from somehow believing we have to do something to recognizing, oh, this is what's happening now, should be understood to meet it in the present moment. The third insight has been understood. Dukkha, suffering, dukkha has been understood. And this is the freedom, actually. What I've seen in my own experience is that when dukkha is really, really deeply understood, so through that exploration, through that present moment experience, when it is truly understood, the heart and the mind let it go. It happens very naturally when the mind truly understands how it is contributing to its own process of feeling suffering. The mind begins to let go of that. And in some ways, it's not something we can consciously do. There are times when we can recognize, yeah, that way isn't so helpful. Maybe I could try something else. And that's it. We have to do that. In our lives, we have to take that action. And yet the deeper releases around suffering happen because we have fully understood them. And then it happens more naturally and organically. It happens because of the understanding. The release happens because of the understanding. It's not something we have to choose. And it almost happens because this is the direction our body and mind want to go. You know, our body and mind, inherently, I think, as human beings, most of us, I think there are a few people who have something in their brains that for whom this may not be true, but it's the rarity. I think it's the unusual thing the way the normal processes of body and mind want to go is towards well-being. And there are so many ways that our thought patterns and our beliefs and our views have kind of co-opted that process of heading towards well-being to, well, I want to head towards well-being in this way. Let me, you know, I'll guide this process towards well-being. And we are actually missing that, like, for instance, in that description of, you know, the wanting and a particular outcome. You know, we think we're heading towards well-being by wanting that particular outcome, but we're missing the fact that in this very moment, we are not in a state of well-being. We're in a state of being out of balance, out of kilter. And so the being present in the moment, understanding the experience in the moment begins to give the mind an education in what's actually going on and gives it the information it needs to head towards well-being very organically. And it will do that. I mean, it's like, yay, the mind and body want to do it that way. We just have to give it the information it needs to head that way. Sometimes Gill talks about a biological imperative towards awakening. I think that's kind of what this is. So I talked longer than I thought, but we do have a couple minutes, so if there's any comments or questions. Yeah.
Perhaps a slightly trivial comment, which is why I waited to see if anybody else was going to say anything. But when you said dukkha, I was right, because in Hebrew, if you want to form the comparative form of an adjective, you just repeat it twice. So in Hebrew, better is good, good, and best is good, good, good.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
This is when you said dukkha, I just said, well, that's like...
The intensification of...
more.
In a way, it is that. The other piece of it, though, is that the word dukkha has multiple meanings in Pali. And one of the meanings is simply pain or unpleasant. So the dukkha of reactivity due to the unpleasantness of experience. So I think it may have multiple overtones to it. I mean, that there's so many. Buddha was like a master of language, so so it has multiple layers of meaning to it.
When you were saying resistance is futile, I thought, okay, so the Buddhist philosophy is resistance is futile, which you still won't be assimilated.
Well, I don't know about the assimilated piece, but I understand that, but I'm not sure about what it refers to. So, but the assimilated, you know, in a way, I think that as we recognize resistance is futile, there's a kind of a deep happiness. Yeah. So now we do need to stop. So. Your laundry is doing. Yes, there is a way of that. That yes, the never-ending nature of having to feed ourselves, clothe ourselves, change. Yes, that is a form of dukkha too.